Cuando compras en la venta del 4 de julio de JCPenney y usas el cupón de 25% extra, no solo ahorras 25% extra en tus favoritos para el fin de semana, te estás ganando el título de Master Griller de por vida con 25% extra. La prueba está en el recibo. Sí, es JCPenney. Cupón válido hasta el 6 de julio en selección de estilos. Aplican algunas exclusiones. Detalles en la tienda o jcp.com.
This is the official Trump campaign war room, and they are embracing nakedly racist memes. And, you know, we do have to ask ourselves, you know, on Earth 2.0, this would be dominating the news cycle. We'd be talking about Willie Horton. Why is this acceptable? Republicans would be asked everywhere, what do you think of the way that he is playing the race card? And with Trump this year, it feels like it's just another day that ends with why. And I think this is another example of how he's sort of become numbed, and his various pathologies have become normalized.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center left to center right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is Charlie Sykes, one of the founders of the Bulwark, currently MSNBC contributor and author of the Substack newsletter To the Contrary, which I highly recommend to all of you. If I run into financial reverses in the coming years, it's going to be because I subscribe to so many great Substacks. But honestly, Charlie, yours is so great. I have to have it. Have to have it. All right. What a 3 weeks we have had. It has just been one of the most remarkable political moments that I've ever lived through, I have to say. Watching the entire mood shift in the country, the upending of politics of the race. So, just to put some numbers on what we're talking about, we have an Emerson College national poll of very likely voters that has Harris at 50 and Trump at 46. I know, I hear all you people out there who are political junkies. You're saying, oh, national polls don't mean anything. What about the swing states? Okay, swing states. Cook Political Report survey of 7 key swing states found Harris leading Trump in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, North Carolina, and Arizona, tied with him in Georgia, and Nevada being the only state swing state in which Trump still has a narrow lead. Some of Harris's leads in these states are within the margin of error. Charlie Sykes, this is quite a change, and you even, I don't think you tend to give in to optimism too frequently, but you even had a post this week where you just said, okay, these optimism vibes, come on, it's hard to resist, right?
Exactly. I mean, I try to resist hype and irrational exuberance, but damn, this is real what's happening. And I don't think that any of us have ever seen anything remotely like the last three weeks. In fact, I don't think anything like what's happened in the last 3 weeks has ever happened before in American politics. Now, a lot of that is mood, a lot of that is vibes, but there's also, you know, tangible evidence that it's real. You know, when you look at the money that's coming in, the voters that are being registered, the organic growth on social media, the polls, I think, only capture in part the momentum because they're directional errors. They're just arrows. They're just a snapshot. But I think we saw here in Wisconsin this last week where we had a partisan primary, the first fruits of this voter engagement and enthusiasm, because the Democratic turnout exceeded everybody's expectations. So at least for the moment, this is real. We have a long way to go. I think that, you know, counterbalancing what's happening with Harris, you know, I keep coming back to what we all thought on that final day of the Republican convention here in Milwaukee. I remember sitting there in the arena thinking, you know, Donald Trump is in the most dominant position of his political life. and we were talking about the possibility of a Trump landslide. The people at that convention were optimistic. They were giddy. They were absolutely certain that this race was over. And think about what's happened with the Republican Party. Think about the way they've created their own circular firing squads, or the way that Donald Trump is flailing and clearly completely disoriented by the switch out of Joe Biden for Kamala Harris. And, you know, even to this moment, there's no indication that he's figured out how to run this race. So not only have the Democrats got their act together and engaged their voters, but the Republicans really seem to be in a state of real discombobulation.
Let me just follow up with one question about Wisconsin. I don't know if you have this at your fingertips, but there was a big turnout in that Supreme Court race like a year or so ago, and which also, you know, brought a lot of Democrats to the polls. Is this just a continuation of that, or is this something new, or, you know, is it, what's your sense of that?
Well, it is a continuation, but it wasn't inevitable. I think that before Joe Biden dropped out, there was a real problem, real concern among Democrats that they were going to be able to turn out big numbers in places like Dane County in Madison. But you saw that again this week. Look, there were two constitutional amendments on the ballot. I mean, they're very, very wonky. They would have stripped a little bit of power from the Democratic governor. They're not sexy. They're not high profile issues. And yet you had a tremendous turnout in Democratic areas, and it went down by a very surprising margin. So it does seem that that's in place. And I will tell you that the Democrats are saying that this exceeded their expectations. And Republicans here in Wisconsin are increasingly concerned about the lack of their ground game. Their ground game has really fallen apart in the Trump era. And you're continuing to see some of the erosion of Republican support in the suburbs.
Interesting. Damon, so there's a debate now about, and we talked about it a little bit last week, you know, what does Harris need to do? Does she need to have a sit down with, you know, one of the big anchors on one of the, you know, legacy networks, or, you know, something like that? Or does she not have to? Can she ride the vibes all the way to when voting starts in late September, which, by the way, is not that long off? But you know, the argument has been made. I think Bill Kristol made it this morning in Morning Shots, where he said, look, there's a lot to be said for vibes in American politics. I mean, there isn't. One of the things that I think I have learned since the era of Obama is how little voters actually pay close attention to matters like policy and where people stand on particular issues. They just get a generalized sense of the direction the person wants to go and their personality and their leadership qualities, and they vote like that. And so if that's, well, tell me, do you agree or disagree with that analysis of how campaigns actually happen?
Well, as a member of the press, as attenuated as that might be, as just a little, you know, a humble Substack scribe, I do sort of want to see the Democratic nominee stand up and take an interview and answer some hard questions, especially as we talked about last week about her changes over time, the fact that she embraced so many left liberal positions, progressive positions in 2019, and seems to have officially abandoned many of them, but without giving any explanation. But I will also say that, as you indicated, I think when it comes to political strategy, especially in the current one where she conveniently got to avoid having to go through another primary, where every position she took would have been attacked by a rival for the nomination, she skipped all of that because of the way this unfolded, that she seems to have landed in this incredibly enviable spot. I don't know if you all remember these polls over the last year when, you know, it was almost always Trump v. Biden, of course. But there were occasionally polls where the pollster would ask about other potential Democratic nominees. And sometimes they would even ask generic Democrat. And generic Democrat usually beat any specific Democrat against Trump by skipping a primary, by leaping in and just being the nominee, by being able to distance herself from older positions by a kind of faceless press release, Kamala Harris has managed to somehow end up as generic Democrat. And so people are free to project their hopes, their imaginations onto her, and she can smile and deliver nice zingy attack lines with some sass and defend general Democratic positions. She's not like standing up there and saying nothing, but they tend to be positions that are less fraught, that she doesn't have to stand up and say, this is exactly what I would do about Israel and Gaza. This is exactly what I would do to fix certain problems that people are saying they see and feel in the economy. And so she is in some ways the best of all possible positions. And so if I were advising her, I would say, we have the convention coming up. Ride that as well as you can. Then we have a week or two till the first debate. Figure out how to get through that, what the best tactics are to stand up to Trump. And then look at where we are now in the heading into the second half of September already. And maybe the best thing for her to do is to keep running as generic Democrat, much as, again, the journalist in me thinks, oh, this is a degradation of our system. But, you know, maybe, you know, would I rather see that than where we were a month ago, where everyone knew where Biden stood because he's been president, but yet he's floundering and he's in a kind of tailspin toward what was looking increasingly like a certain defeat. I'd be much happier with voting for generic Democrat Kamala Harris.
So, Linda, in addition to the advantages of being generic Democrat, Kamala Harris has going for her the fact that inflation has now ticked down below 3% for the first time. Crime is way down. Border crossings are way down. And both Arizona, a swing state, and Missouri, which is not, but they have both put abortion referenda on their November ballots.
That's exactly right. And, you know, by the way, I've never had pretensions of being a journalist, so I'm not speaking here as a journalist. I do think that whether you call it vibe or momentum, or simply the quality that I think is most important in a candidate, likability, Kamala Harris wins. I think she's doing a great job. This has been a remarkable turnaround, but I also think we have to remember who she is running against and what we are seeing out of
Linda, can you hold that? We're going to come to Trump in the second segment.
Okay. I won't say anything more. But, I will say though, but in terms of Kamala Harris and her positions, the fact is that she isn't that well defined. She has had positions in the past that have been left of center, the Green New Deal, you know, getting rid of private insurance, those things were not particularly popular, but it wasn't as if they defined her career. They didn't define her career in the Senate. She was only briefly a candidate for president in 2019. So, and frankly, one of the reasons she failed is that she couldn't even quite explain the let's get rid of private insurance. So I think she is in many ways a blank slate. And it is absolutely true. People like us read the New York Times, we read the Atlantic, we read, you know, Substack journals. We are immersed in this stuff. We love policy. Bill Galston is an absolute expert on statistical analysis, and I always, you know, wait to hear from him. But that isn't really the way most Americans react. And they are reacting to her. They're reacting to the joy. They're reacting to... They now see two happy people out there. Just before I came upstairs, went downstairs to make a cup of coffee, and I heard all of this laughter in the background. I heard all this cheering. I walked into the TV room. Guess who was on? It was Kamala Harris and, by the way, Joe Biden. They were in Prince George's County in Maryland. And you have this sense of people excited. You know, it is something out of our political past. And you saw this in winning Democratic candidates before. And I think those of us, you know, who are very immersed in picking our candidates based on what policy positions they have on foreign policy or domestic policy, ignore the fact that that is not the way most Americans make their choice. And so I think she's doing just fine. The problem with sitting down for a lengthy interview is you don't want to upset the apple cart. She's doing just fine as is. She is coming up to the line of journalists who are traveling with her and answering a few questions here or there so that she doesn't look like she's afraid of the press. But I don't think we have to see any long, in-depth interview. And it isn't as if the other candidate would do very well in such situations either. I won't mention his name since we'll save that we'll for the next segment.
Next segment. Okay. So Bill, so she is going to unveil an economic program this week. It's been hinted at. She's going to propose the first ever federal ban on price gouging on food and groceries. And she's going to impose stiff penalties, she warns, on food industry if they raise prices beyond limits that the federal government deems acceptable. So I think that sort of policy is much more the Bill Galston sort of thing than the Mona Charon kind of thing. I hate that stuff. I think it has unintended consequences, does not work. You push down here, it pops up there. Bad ideas. But in response to everything you've heard, by the way, first of all, it's very popular. It polls very well. And if everything that everyone on this panel has already said is true, it won't matter at all, will it?
I'm not of the camp that believes that what candidates say about the issues doesn't matter. What they say about the issues matters if those issues matter to voters. Mm-hmm. But many of the positions that candidates have are on issues that don't matter to voters. So surprise, voters don't care about it. So I think we have to use a scalpel here, you know, rather than a machete. As it happens, Mona, my reaction to that proposal was about as negative as yours.
Oh, good.
You know, just because, you know, basic definitional questions.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Right.
You know, too much according to whom.
Exactly. Right? Who's going to decide? Right.
Right. And price controls don't have a happy history outside of wartime. A couple of other matters, responding to the previous conversation, and I too will refrain from mentioning the name that shall not be mentioned until the second segment. I have a slightly different view of doing an interview. It's been my experience that if you're seen as withholding yourself from press scrutiny, the press begins to get frustrated. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that when something goes wrong, they're going to jump on you with more fervor than if you'd been more responsive earlier.
No, that's true.
And so I think this is not a clear choice. Obviously, you don't want to interrupt the momentum, but there's some point at which the momentum interrupts itself, and you really need to be prepared for that. You know, if the assumption by the Harris campaign is that the next 12 weeks are going to be like the past 3 weeks, I think that would be an unwise assumption, and they ought to bolster themselves against rougher times. I'm in favor of rational exuberance, but not irrational exuberance. And this is my second point. We can pick out particular polls and say, they prove X or Y. Individual polls don't prove anything. You really have to look at the relevant averages. And when I look at the relevant averages, you know, what I see is a race balanced on the knife's edge. If you look at the averages, Trump is still leading in 5 out of the 7 swing states. And to pick on my hobby horse, He now has a lead of 0.2% in Pennsylvania, which exactly corresponds to his lead in the national poll averages. I have not relented in my view that as Pennsylvania goes this year, so goes the nation. And that state is balanced on a knife's edge. And so, I believe, is the election, even after three terrible weeks for the man whose name shall not be mentioned and three great weeks for Kamala Harris. So there's still a race out there, folks.
Yes, there. Of course, there is still a race, but the directionally, the polls have been moving in a very, very encouraging direction.
Well, let me put it this way, Mona. There were two components to the Biden deficit. One had to do with the record of the administration. The other had to do with Biden himself. She has wiped out the portion of the deficit that is attributable to Biden himself. And in so doing, she has corralled all of the wandering Democrats and brought them back into the fold, which is a great achievement. But now the harder part starts, you know, because that is not quite enough to get the job done. You know, she will have to get at least her share of the people who've yet to tip their hands. There aren't very many of them left, but in a dead even race, how they go will be decisive.
Okay, let us now turn to the other side, to Trump and the GOP.
Cuando compras en la venta del 4 de julio de JCPenney y usas el cupón de 25% extra, no solo ahorras 25% extra en tus favoritos para el fin de semana, te estás ganando el título de Master Griller de por vida con 25% extra. La prueba está en el recibo. Sí, es JCPenney. Cupón válido hasta el 6 de julio en selección de estilos. Aplican algunas exclusiones. Detalles en la tienda o jcp.com.
Charlie, it looks like Trump spent a good portion of the last 3 weeks trying to settle the most important question of this year, which was, what should he nickname Kamala Harris? He trotted out a few different ones, crazy and laughing and whatever, and he hasn't been able to settle on one. I'm not going to help him out because I think there's an obvious one. I'm not going to put it out there. But look, it does suggest something. You know, my colleague JVL had a piece this week where he talked about how for Trump, for the kinds of voters that Trump goes for, that's exactly the kind of campaign he should be running. One that's based on mud and name calling and insults and nicknames and the rest of it, because Trump's most solid and passionate voters are people who are, you know, only very distantly connected to the political system. They don't vote that often. They vote only when he's on the ballot, and they like this stuff. That's JVL's thesis. What do you think?
Well, I mean, look, the hardcore base is going to vote for him no matter what he does. So let's just set aside that for a moment. You know, right now there are, you know, three different lanes for Donald Trump. He could talk about actual policy, but of course he's completely uninterested in that and incapable of that. So I think we saw that again yesterday. What we've seen from him, though,
just say what he said about the economy? I mean,
that it's not
hilarious.
As important. I mean, but a lot of it was just gibberish.
It was gibberish, but he was kind of like, his aides had said, you have to talk about the economy. So he was like a little schoolboy saying, they tell me I have to talk about the economy. They say it's important, but I don't really think it's so important.
Yeah, I mean, he was all jazzed up, was it a week ago, when the stock market went down, and it was like, this was his big pivot moment, and it's like, by yesterday, it was like, well, never mind.
Yeah.
So what we've seen with this very, very confused Donald Trump is not just the usual insults. Oh, by the way, on the nickname thing, this, I think, is a huge tell, because he's always prided himself on being able to brand somebody with a clever nickname. The fact that he has failed with Kamala Harris is very, very interesting, and that weird, you know, few days when he was calling her Kamabla, which I still do not understand, is another indication that he's flailing, because this is what Donald Trump does. And so instead, we've gotten kind of the flow of the crazy and the ugly. The crazy being, you know, weird stuff like saying, you know, pushing the conspiracy theory that those crowds weren't really there, that it was AI generated, which was just, you know, batshit. And then, of course, you get the ugly, you know, going back to the very the racist memes, which tell me that yes, this may work with the MAGA base, but the uglier this campaign gets, the less likely it is to persuade those key swing, that small segment of swing voters in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And I also think that the factor that we need to keep in mind is that Donald Trump is a desperate man, which makes him dangerous both to the country and to himself. By the desperate, I mean, if he loses this election, he doesn't just suffer personal humiliation. He is going to go into legal purgatory. Whether he goes to prison or not, he's going to spend a lot of time in courtrooms. He can't make those cases go away. So no one should be under any illusion, I don't think anybody here is, that he will ever graciously concede this election or that he will go down easily. They will throw everything they possibly can before the election and after the election, which is going to be ugly and dangerous. I think the uglier he gets, the worse he's going to do. I you know, yes, the base is going to get jazzed up about this, but we've been through all of that. I don't think that's a winning formula. And he's given up on persuasion. This is all about firing up the base. There's no indication that he's trying to persuade. Now, I actually do think there are a lot of issues that he could be talking about that would actually be pretty salient. And that there are vulnerabilities for Kamala Harris. And I think one of the reasons why Republicans are so frustrated is because they go, look at the videos we have. Look at the Oppo research we have. Why are we not pounding on the Green New Deal? Why are we not talking about the, you know, her healthcare positions or the other things that she said? Just go on any of these MAGA websites and you see all the material. And yet Donald Trump is incapable of doing that. So I do think that we're in for a very, very ugly, dangerous campaign. And you can sense among Republicans the frustration that Donald Trump just can't figure out what to do. And so that's one of the reasons why he's going back to sort of he's getting in touch with his id. You know, some of the racist memes that he's putting out feel like they're flashbacks to the 1970s. Why? Because that's what he's been doing for decades and he doesn't have anything new. So I guess I don't think that this is the right way for Trump to be campaigning. The only time that I can think of him being successful was in 2016, where he basically kind of toned everything down for a while. Remember that? He kind of disappeared.
At the end, yeah.
At the end, he kind of toned things down. I don't think he's capable of that this time.
To spell it out, in case people didn't see it, this is from the official Trump campaign organization. It says your home under Trump, and it shows lovely little house with an American flag in the front and lawn and very nice. And side by side, another picture, your home under Kamala. And it shows, you know, a swarm of entirely dark skinned people sort of, you know, grasping at things and an image of disorder. And that's your house under Kamala. So that's, I think, one of the things that Charlie was referring to.
You import the third world, you get the third
world. Oh, that's right. That's right. It says you import the thank you.
And I wrote about this for The Atlantic yesterday. And then again on my newsletter, which is like, why is this not a bigger story? Because it would not be notable if this was some white nationalist fringe Trump supporting website. This is the official Trump campaign war room. And they are embracing nakedly racist memes. And, you know, we do have to ask ourselves, you know, on Earth 2.0, this would be dominating the news cycle. We'd be talking about Willie Horton. Why is this acceptable? Republicans would be asked everywhere, what do you think of the way that he is playing the race card? And with Trump this year, it feels like it's just another day that ends with Y. And I think this is another example of how he's sort of become numbed and his various pathologies have become normalized. But again, this is not something that I think is going to be very effective. I mean, it might be effective in hitting some of the playing to some of the anxieties of swing voters in, you know, among, you know, longtime conservative Republicans. But it's certainly not the kind of message that's designed to persuade voters who have drifted away from the Republican Party.
Well, Linda, speaking of Trump's id, he brought back Corey Lewandowski this week. Another fine, upstanding. Yep, fine, upstanding American to advise him. And, you know, Charlie mentioned some of the crazy stuff that he's been saying and doing, you know, including imagining, but out loud and on Truth Social. And now he's back on Twitter also, where he, you know, he was imagining that Biden was going to be jumping back into the race. I mean, really just fantasizing openly that Biden would come back into the race, which just seems so pathetic and really kind of addled. And the thing about the AI and so on. And so people are saying Trump is losing it. Trump is really, you know, he's really gone around the bend this time. And I have to tell you, as much as I wish that were true, experience teaches that he can go pretty far down, very far down, and then manage to come back. He's kind of like the undead, you know, the you know, unless you drive a stake through his heart, you know, he's going to be back. And so I don't know. I mean, what do you make of his, you know, failure to grapple with the new situation and his crazy comments and the rest of it? Do you think that he will figure out that, yeah, he's got to try to talk about Kamala Harris and not talk about himself and his grievances and his weird fantasies?
Well, I think he shouldn't be talking about Kamala Harris so much as he should be talking about what he would do as president that's going to improve the economy and other things for America. Look, I really do think there has been some very serious cognitive decline going on with Trump. And I think that it is in some ways a disgrace that the press is not going more deeply into that. I mean, we had all these articles imagining what particular ailment Joe Biden had. You know, did he have Parkinson's? Was this early Alzheimer's? Not early, because he's of the age that would be late onset Alzheimer's. But, you know, we talked about the fact that he was having trouble getting words out. When you watch Trump for 5 minutes or more, what you see is scary. Mm-hmm. He really cannot keep a train of thought, even when he has that teleprompter in front of him, as he did in North Carolina, when, as you mentioned, his advisors told him he should talk about the economy. He couldn't even stay on message reading from the teleprompter. And when he would go off, it never made any sense. It was incoherent. He had a whole little bit he did holding up two little containers of Tic Tacs, the breath mints, which apparently he favors. One of them was larger than the other. And apparently in the past, he had used that particular image to make the point that in the before times, before there was inflation, you'd get for whatever it is, $2 or whatever it is, you'd get a big thing of Tic Tacs. Now for the same price, you get a little one. But he couldn't make the point. He never got there. All he did is hold up the two Tic Tacs and just sort of saying, wondering, what's he talking about? Bad breath? I mean, I don't know what the man's talking about. But he goes,
the communist Democrats are causing bad breath.
Bad breath. There you go. And, you know, when you were talking about trying to come up with a nickname, you know, he goes on and on about Kamala's laugh. But he gets the words wrong. He had talked about it as a cackle before. This time he was talking about it as a crackle. Yeah. I don't know what a crackle is, except from my childhood, snap, crackle, and pop, you know, Rice Krispies. So his words aren't making sense. There is something going wrong with this guy. And he can't stay on mission. This idea that his campaign thinks we'll bring in some new people, we'll refashion the image, we'll go out there and we'll make him talk coherently. He is not capable of doing it. And I listened for about a half an hour to that X, whatever it was. It wasn't a conversation. It certainly wasn't an interview. It was just sort of this blathering between two very weird guys. And you sort of wonder how many people are seeing that. And the more people who would see it, who really are sort of on the fence, maybe think they like Trump's policies, I think they're going to become concerned. So I'm for actually spending more time talking about what he's doing, because it isn't even his policy points that need to be analyzed. It is the way in which he talks, his incoherence, and it's worrisome.
Bill Galston, I don't mean to pick on the newspaper that has the good judgment to publish you every week, but some of the folks over at the Wall Street Journal write pieces saying things like, you know, half of what Trump says is insane. He sounds like a lunatic. This is awful. And if he doesn't stop doing this, he might lose. And that would be terrible. And I just, that sort of sums up a particular kind of Republican approach to Trump, which is, he really is awful. And we have to have him be a little bit less awful in public so that he can win, because we're for him. I'm not asking you to account for that. Okay. Forget all that. I'm not going to ask you to account for it. I'm just going to say the professionals who've been running Trump's campaign this year, Susie Wiles and Chris LaCivita, have gotten praised up and down by everybody on all sides as being true professionals who know what they're doing. By the way, did you know that that Susie Wiles is the daughter of Pat Summerall, the CBS sports guy? I never knew that until today. I just found this out. But anyway, she became politics person. They're considered to be completely competent, right? And yet Trump is reaching back for the Lewandowski types at his moment of need. So that does suggest a trend, and respond if you wouldn't mind to what Linda said about his mental state.
Some very good friends of mine engage in long distance psychological analysis, and many of them are very distinguished psychologists and psychoanalysts. I'm in no position to second guess them, although famously they got it dead wrong when they did that with Barry Goldwater. But I'm just going to have to defer to people who have a sense for something like that, because I don't, right? Mm-hmm. That may be true, or it may be exacerbated by the extraordinary reversal of fate that Trump has undergone, right? He spent 3+ years assuming that his opponent was going to be Joe Biden. And he and his campaign came up with reasonably effective strategies for countering Joe Biden. They haven't been able to do that. And it's not the fault of Susie Wiles and Chris LaCivita. If they were running the candidate and not just the campaign would be doing a lot better.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they can't.
No.
Trump is the most antinomian man I have ever seen. What he hates most of all is to be disciplined in any way, to have his will limited in any way. And it's clear to me that he views speech texts as a form of unwanted limitation. Time after time, I mean, we've seen him get 5 minutes into a speech and then look at it and say, this is really boring, right? And go in a different direction. He cannot stand to have his will limited. And when his will leads him in a self-destructive direction, I don't think there's any campaign manager on earth who could prevent him from hurtling himself over that cliff. That's all the long-range psychoanalysis I can do. But for him, not only are rules meant to be broken, they constitute a kind of offense. Against his personal will. A couple of other points, and I will cease and desist. First of all, the fact that he's given up on persuasion is not new news. In case we hadn't realized it before the Republican convention, his selection of J.D. Vance was an announcement to the world, I don't care about healing the breach in the party. I don't care about reaching out to new groups. I don't even care about a governing partner, right? I want to send a clear and unmistakable message. The people I care about are the people who already care about me, and the rest of you can go do something to yourself, which can't be repeated on a family-oriented radio show like this one. He's already given up on persuasion, and he was counting on an enthusiasm gap between his campaign and the Biden campaign to compensate for the absence of persuasive outreach. He's lost that advantage. There is no more enthusiasm gap. So what is he going to do for the next act? I honestly don't know. What we have now, interestingly, and this is my second and final point, is a two-level campaign where, for the most part, the paid media, is focusing on areas of Harris's obvious vulnerabilities. Many of the ads that you see are issue focused, talking about inflation or immigration or the past positions that she's taken. But that paid media is being undermined by the quote unquote earned media, that is Trump himself. If you have one level pulling in one direction and the other pulling in the other direction, then the impact of the paid media is diluted, if not undermined altogether. I think that's what's happening now. If Trump can get in sync with his paid media, he'll be doing a lot better. But of course, that just brings us back to the same problem. That is, he refuses to do what he's told.
So, Damon, one way of summarizing where we are might be to say this race is about nothing but everything. Because it's about nothing in the sense of, what are they arguing about? Whether we should tax tips. Now, I'm against, changing the tax system for tips. But that is such a trivial matter. And
besides which, they're not arguing about it.
That's right. They are. They agree about that. But, there are some issues that have bubbled up. But basically, this campaign, when I say it's about nothing in the sense of the issues that the candidates are elevating, but it's about everything in the sense that you have one candidate who represents a stark departure from America's norms and traditions and democratic processes, and you have another candidate who you can be sure will not challenge the outcome of a free and fair election. And that's everything.
Yeah, I do agree that that is the subtext, although, this wasn't the main point I wanted to make, but just briefly, it is striking how the Harris campaign appears not to be continuing with Joe Biden's favorite approach to combating Trump, which is to emphasize the democracy argument. She seems to be more interested in the weird line saying that these people are strange, sort of diminishing Trump and his threat, talking down to him, condescending, not taking him that seriously, and hoping that not only will help on its own side, but that it also will drive Trump to even greater acts of weirdness and bizarre behavior that then will just intensify the line. And that is an interesting approach. And so far, it seems to be working well. So I would wish her well in continuing with that. The one thing I wanted to add to the conversation up till now is that I don't see that much evidence of decline in Trump, except in the following sense. He has always been, I think Bill is exactly right in describing it as antinomianism or willfulness, a complete unwillingness to be hemmed in that explains his hostility to alliances, to allies in general, to the rule of law, to anyone trying to manage him, and then even down to the more trivial side or quotidian side of staying on message, reading the text on the teleprompter. But it is also true that when he was president, he did do some of that. He delivered State of the Union messages every year, and those were always very boring. He's not great at reading a teleprompter, but he can do it, and he did do it at all four of those. He would only rarely go off text and ad lib, and that wasn't great. But at the Republican convention a few weeks ago, in that incredibly unnerving, bizarre 90-minute tirade, that was like 80% ad-libbed, 20% staying on text, because even when he was reading it, he was throwing in little digressions within sentences. And so the only way in which I see that he's seriously declined is that he's even more himself. He's even less inclined to abide by even the norms of public speech. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I'll add to that is that that creates a huge problem. It was actually would have been easier for Trump to run in 2016 as his current self than it is now. Because when he ran in 2016, he had never been president. We had never had a president anything like him. So all he had to do was use the word disaster over and over again, applied to everything. The Iraq War was a disaster. The financial crisis was a disaster. The border is a disaster. Immigration is a disaster. Free trade is a disaster. The Iran deal was a disaster, and on and on and on. And in that weird way, that campaign was kind of policy oriented in that he was always bringing these things up, but at a level of sophistication of a kindergartner throwing a tantrum and using that word disaster. Now, he was president, wants to say it was fantastic for 3 years, wants to ignore the fact that the last year was an utter travesty where about a million people died of a deadly pandemic, and he acted like a lunatic for much of it, where the cities burned on his watch, where he was not able to reinstill order that has been reimposed since he left office, and then try to make the case that Biden was terrible and reversed all those great things, but now it's not even Biden who's there; it's his former vice president who's running kind of an independent candidacy. That requires like nuanced sophistication of argument that he is utterly incapable of doing, and he was incapable of it 8 years ago. But that bit of debility that we do see shows that he's even less capable of doing it now. And so what you get is just kind of flailing wildly, hoping something sticks. And so far, nothing has. And, I don't really see, a lot of evidence that we're going to see a big change on that score.
Yeah, that was very well said. I would only add that another huge difference, though, between 2016 and 2024 is that in the interim, he has acquired a political party. And they amplify his lies and that they salute and march like, organized soldiers.
I mean, but the irony of that is that, like, as JVL, Jonathan Last, as you noted his very good post that actually appeared on Thursday today about mobilizing the Trump voters and being as crazy as possible does that. The problem is the party that he has acquired actually wants to hone that into a presentable message that will win swing voters and actually get the Haley voters to show up on election day. And the other hangers-on who are sort of willing to vote for Trump while holding their noses. And, that's a tough thing. That would be like Kamala Harris trying to run kind of as a member of the squad while also assuming that she can get Michael Bloomberg to be excited. That's a tough recipe.
Yes. All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now. I want to spend just a few minutes, get everybody's very quick thoughts on how the press has handled this is sort of another bookends story. So in 2016, there was a hack that was performed by WikiLeaks in association with Julian Assange, et cetera. They published the hacked contents of emails from the Democrats to embarrass Hillary Clinton and the Democrats at a key moment in the campaign, right after Trump, right after the Access Hollywood revelations. And it was published. And similarly, there was the decision by BuzzFeed to publish the full contents of the so-called Steele dossier. Now it seems that Iran was able to hack somebody. Reports are that it was Roger Stone. Who knows? I don't know. But that it contains private emails within the campaign, including an evaluation of the strengths and weaknesses of both J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio as a vice presidential pick. It was shopped to the Washington Post, the New York Times, and Politico. None of those outlets has chosen to print what they received. Charlie Sykes, are they making the right decision or not?
Okay, this is a complicated one because I was thinking, you know, in my younger years as a reporter and editor, if I got my hands on something like that, absolutely I would run it because it is news. However, I think we need to be careful what we wish for here. This will not be the, we don't fully, by the way, know who did the hack, what's responsible. It won't be the last hack. There are other malign bad actors out there, China, Russia, Elon Musk, I think that right now, of course, we'd all like to know, you know, what's in their own Oppo research on J.D. Vance. But again, let's be careful where we're going here, because particularly when we're in the era of fakes and artificial intelligence, we just don't know. So I think one of the lessons that maybe we've learned that unfortunately is benefiting Donald Trump right now is that, you know, if there are any norms in journalism, it ought to be very, very cautious about these hacks and about this possibility of dirty tricks. Now, having said that, I do wonder if the New York Times, the Washington Post, or Politico had otherwise gotten their hands on the same documents and were able to verify them, would there be any question about their willingness to publish them? And I don't think so. So no. I think, you know, part of it is, you know, in this new era, we're evolving the journalistic ethics in real time, and nobody actually knows what the rules are. So, look, part of me really wants to know what's in those documents. I understand the journalists were pushing to publish them, but I also think we're entering into a uniquely dangerous period and with very unpredictable outcomes.
Bill, my brilliant Bulwark colleague Mark Caputo had a piece on the Bulwark this week where he said, look, this isn't that hard. The journalistic standard has to be, is it true? That is, can you verify it? And is it newsworthy? And if those two criteria are met, you publish. I am not sure I think it's that simple because there are many situations where members, responsible people in the press elect not to publish even when those conditions apply. You don't publish, for example, the manifesto of a mass shooter. Is it true? Does it shed light on why he did what he did? Yes, it's newsworthy. It's true. But you don't publish it because you don't want to encourage mass shootings. And that is one of the consequences. And that's just one example. There are many others. Where do you come down?
I come down where you and Charlie have just come down. I have nothing interesting to add to this conversation, except to say that the beginning of wisdom is recognizing that in our current circumstances, this is not a simple issue with only one side to it. And once editors have taken that on board, they'll be able to say, wait a minute, and then address to reporters and the entire editorial board and to themselves the question of whether, on balance, it's the right thing or the wrong thing. This will be, I think, a case-by-case determination. It would be very nice if there were bright line rules without exception that covered all conceivable instances. I doubt very much that this is the kind of issue that admits of that kind of simple clarity. So
yeah.
That is a long-winded way of saying that I totally agree with what you and Charlie have just said and have nothing important to add to it.
Linda, the other element of this, of course, that Charlie mentioned, it's important, is that when you're dealing with malign foreign actors, you have to have your antenna particularly sensitive, right?
Absolutely. And I would not have published if I'd been in a position. There is something they could do. If, you know, we don't know what's in these documents. If there is certainly something that is super newsworthy, very damning, one of the things they could do is to assign investigative reporters to try to find out if these things were true, to actually do some legwork, and to come up with independent sources of information and to be able to do that. Now, we don't know. They may be doing that.
They may be doing that, right.
They may be doing that. It's also altogether possible that what they found wasn't all that newsworthy and wasn't all that surprising.
And not worse than the cat ladies.
That's right. Not worse, you know, than the postmenopausal women and the cat ladies and all of the other insults he's basically thrown the way of the most of likely voters in America who are older women. So I think it was really a good sign that they didn't rush to publish this. I wish that in 2016, people had been a little bit more wary of those emails. And it wasn't as if there were, you know, that much, you know, in those as well. It wasn't the kind of smoking gun that some people
really
believed. And so I'm glad they did what they did or didn't do, I should say.
Damon, agree or beg to differ?
Beg to agree. I'm largely as conflicted as everybody else about this. The only thing I'll add is that I suspect we're going to see two things. One is, I think Linda is correct, a lot of these news organizations are going to treat these as leads. Mm-hmm. Like when an anonymous caller calls up a newsroom and says, hey, you know, J.D. Vance said this thing, look into that. And then they don't publish a story saying an anonymous caller just told me this thing about J.D.
Right.
Vance. They actually send reporters out to try to look into it. It's a lead. So I think we will see that, and there will be stories published between now and the election that come out of this leak. Secondly, we might see an actual story about the leak, but it will be what the journalists increasingly love to do, which is second order stories. So it won't be a story, this is what's in the leak. It'll be, did you know we were approached by someone who might have worked for Iranian intelligence and they offered us this and then we responded that way. And here's a tantalizing quote from some of it. And we have a lot more, but we're not letting you know what it is. And so it'll kind of talk around what they found and gesture toward what it was without just say dumping it on a full page of the Times quotes from emails about various things in the campaign, or let alone from the Oppo research they had on Vance. But let me tell you, like, in my opinion, like, the Oppo thing on Vance is just going to be transcripts of all the ridiculous things that he said on every right-wing podcast in the country, which he lived on in 2021. He went on every damn one.
Yep.
And as Jonathan Chait from New York Magazine said in a tweet earlier today, he's like, you know, Vance is the type of guy who, like, everyone else would say, hey, let's go get a burger. And Vance would say, for the sake of our society, we must slaughter cows and dine on their flesh. Like, he just, everything he says is like a kind of extra intellectualized and kind of morally tone deaf insult. And that's his special political talent, such as it is. And so I suspect the Oppo research is probably just a whole lot of stuff that he said that anyone who takes the time to listen to these podcasts can just write down the things he said with his own voice on these things. So
yeah,
I'd be surprised if there's
that
much more.
But don't forget, Damon, that the people who were ordered to do the Oppo research may not have the judgment to know that those quotes were offensive. They would not know that necessarily. So that's part of the problem, right?
Yeah. Although Kellyanne Conway represents the faction in the Trump camp who can't stand Vance. And yeah, I bet her and her faction had some of a role in that Oppo research, which is one reason why she is so strongly against him and has been sort of dishing dirt to undermine
him since. More really well, the well-functioning, well-oiled Trump campaign machine. Bill, you wanted to make another point. Just
very, very quickly. I'm, you know, personally, I'm very cross-pressured on this whole issue because I would love to know what reasons could conceivably have induced a campaign to reject Marco Rubio in favor of J.D. Vance. I thought that Marco Rubio was so obviously the right choice that I, for the life of me, other than conspiracy theories involving the pipeline from Don Jr. to Don Sr., I can't figure out why anybody would have made that choice.
Right. Well, I do think it's evidence of the fact that they are victims. They're high on their own supply, as the saying goes. They live in this hothouse environment where they all talk to one another. And they really do think that their highly online alt-right world is the world, and so they don't see things because of that. That's my perception, anyway. Okay, let us now turn to our highlight or lowlight of the week, and I will start with Charlie Sykes.
Well, I've actually changed my mind about six times on this. You know, my highlight of the week was when I had this weird feeling over the weekend that I didn't identify, and I realized it was optimism that Donald Trump was not our destiny, that Trumpism might actually be a parenthesis bounded on one side by a guy named Barack Obama, and the other side by a woman named Kamala Harris, which would be his worst
nightmare. Well, don't forget Biden.
But I actually think that whole Trump era, we can do the Biden thing some other time. But my highlight really is the primary election here in Wisconsin, where two of the election denying crazies, the most vocal election denial crazies, who had actually campaigned against certifying the election for Joe Biden, were soundly defeated in Republican primaries. I think that was a positive development. Does not mean that the normies are back, however. The low light, I was tempted to go with Kevin Roberts, the president of the Heritage Foundation's bizarre, weird attack on dog parks. But Mona, you inspired me to name the ongoing stolen valor attacks against Tim Walz, which are breathtaking to me how much the right has embraced them, when it is, in fact, just ankle-biting bullshit, just the most trivial thing, and just the dishonorable nature of what J.D. Vance has done in pushing this narrative against a man who served his country honorably for 24 years and was so disabled by his service that there was serious consideration of basically, you know, letting him retire early. In fact, he stayed on. And so all of this, I think, is... You know, even for by the dishonest, insult culture world that we live in, frankly, I'm a lot angrier about it. And my only concern is I admire Tim Walz for, you know, going high when they go low and being gracious about all of this. I hope that it does not read as not pushing back hard enough, because I think that there ought to be more angry pushback against this this smear of a man who served his country for a very, very long time, and by all accounts, quite honorably.
Thank you for that. I had it on my list to get to, but we ran out of time. But it's very important, and I would just recommend to people a piece that The Bulwark ran by Will Selber, mm-hmm. who himself served very honorably for decades in the military and military intelligence. And he has a really comprehensive piece that explains everything you need to know about the stolen valor accusations and why they are scurrilous, really. Okay, Bill Galston.
Well, before I get to my highlight, which could double as a low light, I do want to point out for the record, as a sort of a grumpy Democrat, that we've seen this play before. And as a matter of fact, the same guy who's executing this play against Governor Walz, you know, executed it 20 years ago against John Kerry. I didn't hear as much of a Republican outcry at that time as I'm hearing now.
Well, there were a few differences, Bill. There were some differences. John Kerry came home.
There were some differences, but we're talking about honorable service in both cases that was distorted for political purposes, and that's the through line.
Well, okay, I'm going to let that go.
Thank you. Here's my highlight that could double as a low light. The prime minister of Israel accuses his own defense minister of expressing, quote, anti-Israel sentiments for the sin of telling the prime minister the truth.
Yeah.
And that is that if by the destruction of Hamas, you really mean literally the destruction of Hamas, then it's a war aim that simply cannot be achieved, right? And that if you want to have a realistic approach to this war, you have to have an aim that makes sense in military terms and also, frankly, in political terms. And Netanyahu, said his defense minister, is 0-4-2. And for that, for that sin, Netanyahu goes nuclear against his own defense minister. Words fail me at this point, but it does speak to the issue of what happens when you have a leader of an important country who can no longer bear to hear the truth or even a statement that contradicts his priors. This is extremely dangerous in probably the most volatile region of the world right now. And I was scared before I saw that. I'm really scared now.
Okay, Linda Chavez.
Well, I've been getting worried about my own political philosophy, and I've decided I'm now spending much more time reading left of center sources. So I have to go back and now sort of try to at least dip into right of center sources. And so this week I spent a little time reading the Free Press, and lo and behold, I was terribly, terribly disappointed. Eli Lake had a piece in the Free Press, which is sort of my low light. It's called Kamala Harris and the Election of Laughter and Forgetting. And Eli, in this piece, spends a lot of time on one of my favorite 20th century writers, the Czech dissident Milan Kundera, whose The Unbearable Lightness of Being was a wonderful book about his own society under communism. But what Eli has done is try to claim that the kind of narrative that Kundera puts together about the rewriting of history under the communists is applicable to the Biden administration and to Kamala Harris in particular. And I just found it shocking. I can't imagine if Kundera were still alive, he died last year, that he could look at the Biden administration and America under Biden and compare it to the Trump administration and what Trump has done to American politics. And who would he think might be more rewriting history and distorting history? I can't imagine that he would think that it was the Biden-Harris team. So I was really disappointed. I'm going to continue reading my right of center sources because I think it's important to know what people with whom I used to agree are writing and thinking. But boy, this was a real disappointing foray into the Free Press.
Oh, thank you so much for that, Linda. Yeah, I feel you. It's one of the great ironies of our time that these people on the right who keep calling everybody a communist, they are the ones who bear the greatest resemblance to the Soviet system of airbrushing people out of history. something like 75% of the Republicans still now believe that the election was stolen in 2020. Talk about rewriting history. We were living it. So anyway, okay, thank you for that. Damon Linker.
Well, today I have, at least over the last year or so, the rare occasion to have some good news, a highlight from the Ukraine war between Russia and Ukraine. As I'm sure listeners are aware, the war has not been going great for Ukraine. Well, I guess you could say from the beginning, but there have been moments of optimism and pessimism. And it's been looking fairly bleak, conflict bogged down into sort of World War I style, inches being fought over on the map, and a real sense that it's not clear how this was going to end up. And this week, the Ukrainian army went sort of rogue and decided to change things up. They actually invaded Russia. Now, I am not the kind of guy who usually like goes, yay, they invaded a country. I take these things very seriously. I think war is a bad thing and so forth. And so isn't an escalation a good thing? Well, I will say this is a very good thing. We are stuck in a kind of a holding pattern here, and now the Ukrainians have made a bold move to change things up, to make Russia have to redeploy troops to the other side of the border to try to push out the Ukrainian military who have crossed over into the Kursk region, a very important region. If those of you who know World War II battles will have heard of this. And so that could be very positive if Putin is forced to withdraw troops from the front lines within Ukraine to fortify his own border and try to push out the Ukrainian offensive. But secondly, look, the reality is this war will eventually end. There will eventually be a negotiation over terms. And if this move by Ukraine can seriously strengthen Kyiv's hand at those negotiations, where we're actually not talking about, well, will Russia get this much or will Russia get that much, but what will they exchange over relative gains? Then Ukraine will have greatly enhanced its position at those negotiations, and that is all to the good. So bravo to Zelensky and to the Ukrainians for actually changing things up a little bit. I want to believe the Biden administration knew this was coming. It's smart that they've said, whoa, I had no idea. What is this? Ask them. This is bizarre. That's cagey. You know, we are dealing with a nuclear armed power. We don't want to make it seem like we're okaying an invasion of the Russian mainland. But if we knew it was happening and said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, or dare I even dream that we suggested it and said, if you do it, we'll have your back, then bravo. This is the first time in many months that after this 2.5 years into this conflict where I've actually had a smile on my face.
100%. Slava Ukraine. All right. I want to, I have a low light. I want to talk about a very good piece that appeared in Popular Information by Judd Legum and Noah Sims. And it plumbs the origins of some of Trump's most conspiratorial postings and musings. And a lot of them come from, it turns out, this one particular person that Trump is close to. Her name is Laura Loomer. You may have heard of her. She has been kicked off pretty much every reputable site there is. She has joined forces with the likes of Alex Jones, on various issues. You get the flavor. Well, anyway, it turns out that they looked through her postings and discovered that the origin of the whole idea of Kamala Harris not being black, that was her. They found that the origin of the idea that the Kamala Harris crowd at the airport was AI generated, Laura Loomer. And the origin of those posts that Trump did earlier this year and the year before, posting fake images about family members of judges who were presiding over Trump cases, Laura Loomer. So it is useful to know that inside that rat's nest of a brain that Trump has, that this is the kind of person that he goes to for his information and freely circulates it. Somebody who has been found to be so irresponsible and such a liar that she's been kicked off of pretty much every mainstream platform. That is the kind of person that Trump thinks is a good source. So important to remember that. All right. I want to thank our guest this week, Charlie Sykes, and the regular panel, and of course, our producer, Jim Swift, and our wonderful viewers and listeners. I will be off next week. I have been traveling a fair amount and had a family situation, so I had to miss a couple weeks already this summer, and I'm going to miss next week, but for a good reason. Going to the Canadian Rockies for a genuine vacation. So maybe bad timing since it is a Democratic convention. But anyway, it's done. So I will be gone next week, but you will be in the capable hands of Andrew Egger. And so I bid you all a happy week and Beg to Differ will return next week as every week.